WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For years, he studied stars, but after the public TV series Cosmos, Carl Sagan became a star, America's most popular astronomer. Sagan worked with NASA on the Mariner, Viking, and Voyager planetary expeditions. He's also studied the greenhouse effect on Venus, dust storms on Mars, the clouds of Titan, and the origin of life on Earth. He's a professor of astronomy and space studies at Cornell University, where he also directs the Laboratory for Planetary Studies. In 1982, Sagan was part of a small group of scientists who hypothesized that a nuclear war could have a catastrophic chilling effect on Earth's climate that could end civilization as we know it. The theory is called nuclear winter. It's the subject of a new book Sagan has co-authored. At the time they came up with the theory, there was great fear of a nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. But now relations have warmed, and a strategic arms reduction treaty is in the works. We may soon be at war with Iraq, but Iraq doesn't yet have nuclear capability. I asked Carl Sagan how relevant the issue of nuclear winter is today.
First off, I would say that as long as the United States and the Soviet Union have 55,000 nuclear weapons between them, we are hardly off the hook. If only a tiny fraction, a few hundred of those weapons exploded over cities or petroleum repositories can produce a world climate catastrophe, then it's hardly a time for complacency. Yes, there is progress on a strategic arms reduction treaty, and I applaud that, but that will accomplish a reduction by 30% in the roughly 25,000 strategic weapons and won't even touch the 35,000 or more tactical weapons. It's a step in the right direction, but a very small step. Because this is a time of amity between the United States and the Soviet Union, this is the time to make progress in much more massive reductions in the armaments. Nobody knows who's going to take power in the Soviet Union, or for that matter, the United States, in the coming years. If we say we're happy with the present circumstances, don't bother me, let's not worry about nuclear weapons, everything is cool, then we are saying that we're willing to hand over ourselves and our children and our grandchildren to the sanity and sobriety of every leader now and into the indefinite future of the United States, the Soviet Union, and all other nuclear-armed nations. I myself am not the least bit complacent about that. That's a very worrisome prospect.
I'm going to ask you to give us a basic description of what a nuclear winter would be and what would cause it.
Well, maybe you've seen pictures of a fire in a large modern skyscraper, and you see these roiling clouds of ugly black sooty smoke, astonishingly black. Now, if you burn a modern city, you have the concatenation of all of the buildings in the downtown area burning. If you now have, let's say, 100 cities burning simultaneously, as you would in even a small nuclear war, then you can see that there would be a large amount of this sooty smoke lifted off the surface of the earth. The clouds would merge. They would first spread in longitude and then in latitude, and you can then have a semi-opaque layer of this sooty smoke at altitude covering most of the northern hemisphere and eventually reaching into the southern hemisphere as well. As a result, sunlight has difficulty getting through the layer. It's dark on the ground. The temperatures drop because, after all, it's sunlight that warms the surface. And that is the main aspect of nuclear winter. There are a number of others, including chemically toxic fumes that are produced from the same burning of cities, breaches in the ozone layer, and radioactive fallout. The principal way in which these consequences affect us in the long term is through the destruction of crops, of agriculture. Even a few degree temperature drop, a few centigrade degree temperature drop on a hemispheric average is enough to wipe out much of the food crops in the northern hemisphere. And a study by 300 scientists from 20 nations concluded that the resulting nuclear winter might condemn several billion people to death by starvation. I point out there are only 5.3 billion of us altogether on the planet.
Is a nuclear winter something that the Earth would ever recover from?
Oh, yes. The fine particles would eventually, in some years, entirely or almost entirely fall out or be removed from the atmosphere. And as far as we know, the Earth would recover into its ordinary climatic regime. There are some circumstances in which you push the Earth's climate far enough and it stays where you pushed it, even if the push is stopped. But there is no credible evidence that that would happen here. That is, that we would be plunged into an ice age for 10,000 years or something like that. As far as we can see, that is not likely. But to wipe out most of the human species, unfortunately, is likely.
Astronomer Carl Sagan is my guest. Without getting into this too technically, how did you come up with this theory, you and the fellow scientists who worked on the theory of nuclear winter with you?
For me, it came about in the most indirect and unintentional way. A lot of science occurs that way. It happened in 1971. I was involved in the NASA Mariner 9 mission to Mars, which was, turned out, the first spacecraft to ever orbit another planet. We arrived at Mars. I was involved with the imaging team to take close-up photographs of Mars and found a planet with nothing to see. It was completely covered with a massive dust storm. And we were, of course, interested to know how long it would be before we could actually start our photographic mission. And so we got to calculating what would be the effects of all this dust in the atmosphere. And one of the instruments found something quite interesting, that the atmosphere was much warmer and the surface much colder than it ordinarily is on Mars. And through that step, a long sequence of events, our team, so-called TAPS team, T-T-A-P-S, after the last names of the five of us, developed the machinery to calculate what the climatic effects would be on any planet from putting fine particles up into the atmosphere. It took us essentially a decade before we got around to calculating this for the Earth and for the fine particles put up in a nuclear war. And we did a lot of other things on the way, the results of volcanic explosions, which put fine particles up. How does that cool the Earth? The result of the huge collision that happened with the Earth 65 million years ago of a comet or asteroid that put an enormous amount of fine particles up and seems to have been the precipitating cause of the extinction of the dinosaurs and most of the other species of life on the Earth at that time. Only after all of that did we get around to nuclear war. I wish we had done it sooner.
Let me ask you a question about fire, since you've studied the effects of nuclear-related fire. One possible scenario, if there's war in the Middle East, is that oil refineries would be targeted. There's the possibility for massive oil refinery fires. What are the possible ecological effects should that happen?
Well, you're absolutely right. You don't need a nuclear weapon to blow up a petroleum refinery or an oil field or a natural gas well or a place where fossil fuels are stored. That can be done quite nicely with conventional weapons. You can also burn a city with conventional weapons, and World War II gave plentiful examples of that, Tokyo and Hamburg and Coventry, and so on. So if cities and petroleum facilities are targeted in a Near East war, it is possible that if the war were, you know, not restricted to Kuwait, but fairly wide in the Middle East, it's possible that you could produce enough sooty smoke to have at least regional climatic consequences. Now, we are trying to calculate this. It's a somewhat different story than the nuclear winter situation, and I don't know anyone who has done the calculation yet. But it seems to me that in the face of ignorance, it is wise to be cautious.
In your discussion of the fires that could be caused in a nuclear war, you talk about how fire could release toxics into the air. So much of modern synthetic material is made of substances that become poisonous when burned, and the toxics are released. In getting back to the idea of a possible massive fire in the Middle East as a result of the bombing of oil fields, would you see the likelihood of there being incredibly poisonous fumes, not only from the oil itself, but also from the fire spreading and burning other modern synthetics?
Yeah, modern synthetics and plastics, when burned, produce poison gas. Let's go back to that skyscraper fire that we talked about earlier. You often hear about people overcome by smoke. There was a social club fire in the Bronx less than a year ago, which people had obviously died in seconds. That's not overcome by smoke. That's poison gas. It's a witch's brew of deadly poison gases, of which cyanides are only one. Which are released when we burn plastics and synthetics. And modern cities, including some of those in the Middle East, have large quantities of such synthetics in them. In addition, there are vast storage bins of storage tanks of chemicals that are byproducts of petroleum refining that are also toxic. So the idea that it's okay to burn petroleum facilities in the course of the war has to be looked at a little more closely than, as far as I can tell from public media, has been done so far. I sincerely hope we won't have a war. In fact, it's foolish, and the whole point of the war is clearly not jobs and not the preservation of democracy in a medieval feudal state of Kuwait. What it's about is oil. And if we had continued in the direction that President Carter had charted, the much despised President Carter in the 70s, to have alternatives to our massive dependence on fossil fuels and imported oil, we would not be in this mess today. Then we could safely apply a quarantine, a boycott, and let it run out. I still hope we will be able to do that.
Astronomer Carl Sagan is my guest, and he's one of the scientists who have come up with the theory of nuclear winter, the catastrophic climactic after effects of nuclear war. And he has co-authored a new book about that called A Path Where No Man Thought. And we'll talk more with Carl Sagan about this and other issues that he's worked on after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Carl Sagan is my guest. You're very interested in space research and exploration of the planets. A lot of that research has been funded, well, has been related to military research as well. And I know that the military is interested in space exploration in part because of space weapon systems. You must be very ambivalent about that, because the military's interest in space helps promote causes that you're interested in, too. On the other hand, it kind of gets the world a little closer to the possibility of nuclear war.
Well, I mean, it certainly is true that that the race to the moon, the Apollo program, was fundamentally about the strategic confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union. It was certainly not about science, even though some good science came out of the Apollo program, although We could have gotten, I believe, just as good science for a whole lot less money by sending smart robots to the moon, but that's not the way it worked out. But in the kind of exploration that... you mentioned a moment ago that the military is interested in space exploration. They're not. They're interested in the exploitation of the space environment, but not in exploration. They're not interested in finding out what's on other planets. They're interested in using for military purposes, both defensive and offensive, the environment, the near space environment around the Earth. So the two interact only very loosely and largely in the realm of rocket vehicles. For example, the Voyager missions to the outer solar system were lifted by a Titan launch vehicle, and Titan comes directly out of military technology, even though the boosters themselves are not classified. But still, it's I always bear in mind this strange fact that the same technology that we use, the rocket technology, the nuclear power technology Voyager and Viking used thermoelectric nuclear energy sources, and the electronics and computer technology, the same technology used to send spacecraft to other worlds, can also be used to send the agents of mass murder halfway across the planet.
You had always been very interested in Mars, and I'm wondering how the most recent findings about the planet have affected your interest, if it contradicts your expectations.
Well, one of the wonderful things that happens in the spacecraft exploration of the planets is the discovery that everybody's expectations about every world in the solar system are wrong, and that's because nature is much more clever than we are, much more subtle, much more elegant. Our ability to imagine what's out there is tremendously constrained, first of all by our own intellectual limitations, and secondly by the fact that we grow up on this one planet, and this planet isn't like any other planet. So in the case of Mars, it's a world of wonders, but with all sorts of things that nobody had guessed before we went there. For example, the surface of Mars is covered with a network of ancient river valleys. And yet today, the temperatures on Mars are so low and the atmospheric pressure is so low that liquid water is impossible. There is no liquid water on Mars. How could these rivers have formed? And the consensus answer in the scientific community is that there was once a time, several billion years ago, when the temperatures were warmer, there was much more atmosphere, and the surface was awash in liquid water. Now, how did that climate change occur? What happened on Mars to convert it from pretty close to Earth-like conditions to the deep ice age environment it's in? Isn't that something we who are pushing and pulling and tugging on our planet ought to understand? Also, if the conditions were so Earth-like then, that's a time when on Earth the origin of life had happened. Could life have arisen in that early benign environment on Mars and maybe still be around, although the Viking results show not a hint of life? Or maybe life arose and evolved and then became extinct, and there are fossil forms waiting us on Mars. Either possibility is, to me, tremendously exciting.
I think a lot of people feel, well, you know, space is really fascinating, but what possible relevance will it have for me in my lifetime? And what relevance does it have for me now, especially at a time like this, when people on Earth might be soon involved in a catastrophic war? What would you say to that? I mean, do you start to feel like it's less relevant in times like this?
Well, it's the first thing I would say is that we have to be very careful not to think of only one item at a time. There are many issues on the public and national agendas, and we have to bear many in mind. I certainly hope that the White House does that. by exploring other planets, we better understand our own. And we have an urgent need to understand our own planet because our technology is now so powerful that we're able to make profound changes in our planet. And depletion of the ozone layer and letting in deadly ultraviolet light from the sun is one example. Greenhouse warming from the burning of fossil fuels, you know, coal, oil, natural gas, is another. Nuclear winter is a third. All of these are ways in which our technology, almost without us knowing it, without hardly anybody paying any attention, now poses a danger to ourselves. Now, in all three of these cases, we have learned a great deal about them by studying other nearby planets. They are examples of Earth-like worlds that have gone in other directions. And so if you didn't have an ounce of adventuresome spirit in you, if you didn't care at all about what other worlds were like, if the question of the origin of the Earth and the origin of life didn't interest you, whatever, I still maintain that you ought to be a strong proponent of the exploration of other planets just from the straightforward, practical, environmental information that comes out of it. There's lots of other reasons to do it, but I claim from a bottom line, no-nonsense, no-romanticism point of view, it still makes enormous sense for us to be exploring the planets.
You are an astronomer. When you walk outside your house at night, can you actually see the stars?
Oh, yeah. I live in upstate New York where it is at least sometimes clear enough to see the stars, and occasionally you can see them with enormous splendor.
It's understood that the first photographs that were sent back from space of Earth had a profound effect on people involved with the environmental movement, because here you were able to see Earth from a distance, and suddenly the planet looked comparatively small and very fragile, and that, I think, helped give a lot of impetus to the environmental movement. I'm wondering what kind of personal effect those photos had on you when you first saw them.
Well, I agree. They were tremendously moving. You saw this world, and the continents had exactly the configuration alleged by the map makers. They knew their stuff. And you could see it as a lovely blue and white world set against this velvet backdrop of space. And immediately the vulnerability and fragility of the Earth cries out to you. I had the opportunity recently when the Voyager 1 spacecraft had passed the orbit of Neptune and Pluto to be involved in turning the cameras around and photographing the Earth from that distance, beyond the furthest known planet. And there it was as a point of light, a pale blue dot on which lived every human being we love, we've heard about, every human being that ever lived, every inventor, every corrupt politician, every lover, every child, every great religious leader, all lived out their days on that blue dot. I found that a tremendously inspiring experience, and sort of renewed my dedication to preserving and cherishing this little world.
Carl Sagan, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
And my guest has been astronomer Carl Sagan, and he's the co-author of a new book about nuclear winter. It's called A Path Where No Man Thought. Next time, we debut a new Fresh Air theme, and we feature a concert with its composer, Joel Forrester, of the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.